This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, April 6th, 2013, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. This year, Holocaust Remembrance Day, Yom HaShoah, is on Sunday, April 7th. It may be too late to obtain one in time for your celebration, but the taxpayer-funded U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum offers a free CD or DVD for planning activities on that day, and it is available from that museum. Following the 1948 establishment of the Israeli state, Jews in America did not talk about the Holocaust and had abandoned many of the fundraising appeals for Israel. In the late 1950s, only about 21% of the American Jews thought it important to financially support Israel. Adolf Eichmann's trial in Jerusalem began on April 11, 1961. The Israelis indicted him on 15 criminal charges, including crimes against humanity, war crimes, crimes against the Jewish people, and membership in an outlawed organization. David Ben-Gurion, during that trial, promoted the idea that the majority of the 6 million Holocaust victims would have been heirs and would have relocated to Israel. However, by 1967, many Jews had steadily decreased their donations to that state. Israelis ignored Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, and textbooks paid little attention to it. Instead, most American Jews viewed Israelis as strong rather than as vulnerable victims. Because of the loss of their victimhood status and the cash flow shortfalls, the Jews emotionally connected the Holocaust to the escalating crisis in the Middle East. Reportedly, according to the Jewish-controlled U.S. press, the Arabs were determined to wipe Israel off the map and drive the Jews into the sea. The unified Jewish community politically exploited those claims and began politicking and fundraising. Actually, Israel was in no danger, but quite the opposite. It was the aggressor. Before Israel assaulted its militarily deficient neighbors on June 5th through the 10th of 1967, President Lyndon Johnson's intelligence network surmised that the war would be over in a week or 10 days. Yet, the American media continued to claim that Israel was on the brink of destruction and planted the perceptions of a possible new Holocaust. The previously disseminated media images of dead and dying, emaciated victims of World War II quickly reinforced historical claims and transformed them into imminent probabilities. Predictably, the Israeli state triumphed with the capture of Jerusalem, the West Bank, the Golan Heights, Gaza, and the Sinai. Jews living in America used this victory to establish perpetual objectives in the fields of fundraising, the collection of past reparations, lobbying, and in more fully controlling America's politicians. The Six-Day War, with the American government's compliant silence of the Israeli assault on the USS Liberty on June 8, 1967, cemented the relationship of Jews living in America to Israel. The Six-Day War, as cleverly conceived, connected Israel to the Holocaust. Americans to this day do not know about the Israeli attack on that ship because of the complicit cover-up by the government and the controlled media. There were 294 survivors from the premeditated Israeli attack directed by Moshe Dayan, including 171 men who were injured. The Israeli attack using phosphorus and other lethal weapons slaughtered 34 men, while they never found the remains of 5 men, and they had to put body parts into sacks for burial. The Six-Day War, like all other wars, had economic objectives. Additionally, the Jews wanted to implant the idea of a renewed Holocaust. However, given the Israeli state's victory, those fears were unviable. People could no longer portray the Jews as pathetic, submissive victims as they now appeared invincible. The Jews could now incorporate the Holocaust with the Six-Day War to create an ongoing salvation myth. To implement this fully, the Jews had to instill the Holocaust myth into the American consciousness as unquestioned official history. The Holocaust had to maintain a connection with Jews living in America. Remember, Jews may bash Israeli policies, but to remain a loyal Jew, one may never, never question the Holocaust or Germany's alleged involvement in it. Remember what his co-religionist did to David Cole? Significant evidence against the historicity of the Holocaust is readily available. If otherwise intelligent people ignore it, question their motives. Honesty about the Holocaust should be a litmus test for other issues. Continual reference to Hitler, synonymous with the Holocaust, reinforces the belief. When one hears radio hosts continually bash Hitler, the Nazis, or talk about the Reichstag fire, the Gleiwitz incident, or Kristallnacht, then you can glean an inkling of their allegiance to Holocaustianity. One of the most recently resurrected myths to emerge is how Hitler imposed gun control. There are numerous books about these issues revealing the actual facts. However, many people would prefer to get their perceptions about history from Hollywood movies, television dramas, or from court historians whose books often appear on the New York Times bestseller list. There is a saying that I enjoy: those who will not read have no advantage over those who cannot read. Therefore, I must assume that those radio hosts that I am referring to simply do not know how to read, or they are merely demonstrating their allegiance to Holocaustianity. They certainly do exhibit a remarkable ignorance of history and a total avoidance of objectivity. Since 1945, the Jews, in an attitude of recrimination, refer to the world's silence, the world's indifference, and the abandonment of the Jews. Look magazine published in serial format Arthur Morse's Accusatory, While 6 Million Died, A Chronicle of American Apathy, and then other companies published Morse's work in book form in 1968 and again in 1998, just before America's second invasion of Iraq on behalf of Israel. To emphasize and impose guilt upon others, the Jews adopted the slogan, "Never Again." Nash Publishing, in 1971, published Rabbi Meir Kahane's Never Again, A Program for Survival. In 1968, Kahane had founded the Jewish Defense League, the JDL, to protect Jews from anti-Semitism by whatever means necessary. According to the FBI, the JDL has been involved in plotting terrorist attacks within the United States. The Jews, by imposing collective guilt, essentially demanded ongoing support for Israel. The Jews applied the exhortation, "Never again," to themselves. Milton Himmelfarb, the uncle of Bill Kristol, said that never again, and I quote, "Never again would we let others fool us, or would we fool ourselves about the intention of those who intended to destroy the Jews," unquote. Oscar Cohn of the Anti-Defamation League wrote that by the 1970s, Jews in America had become an agency of the Israeli government. They experienced Israelization, and one's fervent commitment to Israel became the characteristic of the good Jew, superseding all other factors previously considered essential. Public criticism of Israel became unforgivable. Given Israel's obvious long-term policies towards Palestinians, many Jews criticize Israeli policies, but not without negative consequences. However, Jews must never never question the Holocaust story or German culpability, despite incontestable empirical scientific evidence that clearly discredits the official account. The Yom Kippur War of 1973 reinforced that connection. The media continued to exploit the fears of another Holocaust to justify Jewish aggression. Meanwhile, the perception of Jews as military heroes effectively diminished the stereotype of passive victims. The Israeli state's miraculous victory facilitated the merging of the Holocaust into Jewish religious dogma. Religious Jews had to resolve the horrific Holocaust with the idea that they were God's chosen people. To do this, they characterized the Six-Day War as the theology of Holocaust and redemption, a David and Goliath event. Their purification occurred in the burning ovens of Auschwitz and functioned as a rite of passage. Thus purified by their suffering, followed by their triumphal victory, the Israeli state on June 9th celebrated the return of the people of Israel to the ancient wall of the Temple of Jerusalem. The extermination of European Jewry functioned to fulfill Talmudic prophecy, a provocative concept that would use the influence of many American Christians. Rabbi Irving Greenberg later became a director of President Carter's Commission on the Holocaust. In 1967, before the Six-Day War, a Jewish organization distributed a leaflet at Yale University urging Christians, and I quote, "because of their special ties to the people of Israel," unquote, to speak out about Jewish vulnerability in the Middle East. Those so-called special ties are certainly not reciprocal. Israel Shahak wrote that certain rabbis instruct Jews to burn, publicly if possible, any copy of the New Testament that comes into their hands. On March 23, 1980, they ceremonially burned hundreds of copies of the New Testament in Jerusalem under the auspices of Yad al-Akim, an Orthodox Jewish organization founded in 1950 and subsidized by the Israeli Ministry of Religions. To maintain the idea that Israel was isolated and vulnerable, the Jews living in America had to give emphasis to the fading memories of Nazi crimes against the Jews. They had to indoctrinate new generations of people to retain support for the Israeli state. The Anti-Defamation League is especially active in these educational efforts. ADL officials Arnold Forster and Benjamin Epstein wrote a book immediately after the Yom Kippur War. Jewish claims following World War II generated sympathy for the alleged 6 million Jewish victims and helped open doors. Truman based his official recognition of the State of Israel on those claims. However, within 25 years, people no longer viewed the Jews as isolated victims. People had forgotten all about the Holocaust. The Israeli state chose warfare and rejected Anwar Sadat's peace overtures in the early 70s. The Israeli state attacked a Libyan airliner in early 1973, resulting in the deaths of 100 civilian passengers. We didn't hear a lot about that. It was not long before many began to sympathize with the Palestinian struggle. They are the authentic victims. In 1969, Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir had declared that the Palestinians did not even exist. Many Jewish organizations ignored the supplications of their victims and others, and instead viewed their own difficulties as stemming from the world forgetting about the Holocaust. Jews expect the Holocaust to minimize criticism of Israel, even if that criticism is justifiable. They seem to ignore the rights of others and won't even discuss them. While the Israeli state effectively conceals its war crimes in the Middle East, Jews in America persuasively peddle the Holocaust story to a new generation of non-reading, naive people. Jews living in America exploited the Holocaust story to mobilize validation of Israel. People rationalized support for the Israeli state depending on their audience. Some argue that Israel is an important strategic asset and point out that Russia supports Israel's enemies. Christian Zionists claim that the Jewish presence in Palestine fulfills biblical prophecy. Peter Novick wrote, and I quote, "Only a few months after the top officials of the Anti-Defamation League had proclaimed that it was fading memories of Nazism's crimes against the Jews that accounted for Israel's isolation, the ADL decided to embark on an ambitious venture in Holocaust programming," unquote. Its public relations consultant recommended a program designed to inflict guilt on everyone for what the Jews had suffered. David Singer of the American Jewish Committee claims that Holocaust deniers attempt to, and I quote, "rob the Jewish people and the state of Israel of their moral capital," unquote. Edward Alexander states that the wrong interpretation of Nazi atrocities or the universalization of the Holocaust plunders the moral capital that Jews have accumulated. They complain about the kidnapping or the appropriating of the moral capital they earn via their suffering during the Holocaust. One Jewish organization complained about the presence of Christian symbols at Auschwitz. The Jewish state bases its legitimacy on what happened to Jews during the Holocaust, even if it is fiction. The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, sent a copy of a novel based on a popular Hollywood Holocaust TV series to each member of Congress in hopes of influencing the sale of U.S. aircraft to Saudi Arabia. Propagandists have always used novels, and in this case, Hollywood, to evoke sympathy and support. The ADL emphasized a relationship between the Holocaust and Israel while comparing the Palestinians to the Nazis. Hollywood contributed to the propaganda by producing Exodus, based on Leon Uris's novel. In the film and in the novel, an escaped Nazi shrewdly masterminded Palestinian terrorism. In Frederick Forsyth's The Odessa File, also a film, several Nazis joined forces with the Arabs to destroy Israel. However, any documentation of a connection between the Nazis and the Palestinians is non-existent. The Israeli state justifies their preemptive treatment of the Palestinians, remuneration for the Holocaust by claiming the Palestinians were involved in the deliberate killing of European Jews. The four-volume Encyclopedia of the Holocaust uses the case of the Mufti of Jerusalem, a Palestinian nationalist leader who spent World War II in Germany to escape incarceration by the British to make the connection between the Palestinians and the Nazis. One person only who simply went to Britain. Unbelievable. Or went to Germany, excuse me. That is amazing. On February 21st, 1991, 1 week before the Gulf War officially ended, the headline in the Brooklyn-based The Jewish Press, the largest independent weekly Jewish newspaper in the United States, declared, and I quote, "Iraqis have gas chambers for all Jews," unquote. In the spring 1991 special edition of Response, the Wiesenthal Center World Report, headlines claimed that the Germans had produced Zyklon B and gas chambers in Iraq. In 2010, Enigma Books, in association with the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, published Nazi Palestine, The Plans for the Extermination of the Jews of Palestine, written by Klaus Michael Malmann and Martin Kuppers, two German historians, court historians. The taxpayer-funded U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum has sponsored and published, often in association with other publishing entities, 66 books about the Holocaust. On its website, we read, and I quote, The Center's Academic Publications Program disseminates scholarly output in the field of Holocaust studies through direct publication and co-publishing arrangements, the works appearing in a variety of formats. The aim of these publication projects is to shed new light on previously unstudied topics, fill significant gaps in the literature, correct important misconceptions about Holocaust-related subjects, and facilitate access by scholars and the general public to the study of the Holocaust, unquote. Read that as programming and propaganda. Just exactly how did this museum come about? The Holocaust, ostensibly the unprecedented systematic extermination of 6 million Jews by Nazi Germany during the Second World War, was unique. Because of this alleged exclusivity, on November 1, 1978, President Jimmy Carter, via Executive Order No. 12093, appointed Elie Wiesel as chairman of the newly created 34-member Commission on the Holocaust, which began its operations on January 15, 1979, to evaluate, and I quote, the establishment and maintenance of an appropriate memorial to those who perished in the Holocaust, unquote. Interestingly, an Israeli lawyer recently filed a class action suit against Carter, seeking $5 million in damages because his book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, allegedly defamed Israel. What a shame. Elie Wiesel said, and I quote, "For the dead and the living, we must bear witness. For not only are we responsible for the memories of the dead, we are also responsible for what we are doing with those memories," unquote. Five congressmen and five U.S. senators were and still are part of the commission, along with a 27-person advisory board. For financing, the commission was to, and I quote, "examine the feasibility of obtaining funds for the creation and maintenance of the memorial through contributions by the American people," unquote. So I guess in addition to giving all this money, that the government gives all this money to Israel, I guess it's the American people are supposed to also fund the museum. Further, and I quote, "the commission shall recommend appropriate ways for the nation to commemorate April 28th and 29th, 1979, which the Congress had resolved shall be Days of Remembrance of Victims of the Holocaust, DRVH. The commission advocated an annual and perpetual Days of Remembrance of Victims of the Holocaust, beginning on the Sunday of or preceding the International Holocaust Commemoration Day. The commission recommended that the National Holocaust Museum, a national institution, accept the responsibility of developing ways of honoring the Days of Remembrance. The commission was to initiate a congressional resolution calling for the observance of Days of Remembrance. Each year, the USHMM, that is the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, designates a special theme for Days of Remembrance of Victims of the Holocaust observances and prepares materials to support observances and programs throughout the nation. And obviously, this is mostly taxpayer-funded. On April 24, 1979, in anticipation of the Commission's report, the government held the first national civic commemoration in the Capitol Rotunda, with an address delivered by President Carter. Currently, the U.S. sets aside an 8-day period, from the Sunday before Yom HaShoah to the Sunday after Yom HaShoah. Congress established this period for remembrance programs, ceremonies, and special educational programs with the participation of states, cities, and military ships and stations. Officials hold the annual National Civic Commemoration in the Capitol Rotunda. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum provides support materials linked to an annual theme. Through the long-term efforts of a Navy Jewish chaplain, Rabbi Arnold Reznikoff, the Department of Defense began participating in the Days of Remembrance of Victims of the Holocaust. On April 1, 1984, Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger would sign a memorandum to the military services urging the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and other military commanders to participate in the annual program for the first time. The Defense Department has produced a resource guide for military programs. The Defense of the Department of Defense guide contains the history of the DRVH, a sample ceremony for military installations and materials that groups could use in their educational programs and ceremonies. The Department of Defense divided it into 8 sections. Number 1, the Liberators. Number 2, the Horror. Number 3, the Process of Annihilation. Number 4, Bystanders and Collaborators. Number 5, the Response. Number 6, Resistance and Rescue. Number 7, The Shadow. And number 8, America Remembers. All this is reinforcement of the official version of history, which includes, of course, the official version of the Holocaust. Other objectives of the committee, this is Carter's committee, was number 1, the commission joins with the U.S. President in urging the Senate to ratify the Genocide Convention. The commission wanted to punish the criminals, of their choice, of course, involved in the genocidal activities of World War II. And this was basically the punishment of Germany and all of Germany's citizens. Number 2, the prosecution of Nazi war criminals in America. The commission wants the government to grant, and I quote, high priority to the investigation and prosecution of Nazi war criminals in America, to ensure adequate funds and staffing for the Office of Special Investigator charged with the prosecution of accused Nazi war criminals in our midst, unquote. Number 3, Jewish cemeteries abroad. The commission recommends that in recognition of the sanctity of the physical remains, and this is a quote, the physical remains of Jewish communities of Eastern Europe and the right of the dead to a final resting place, the State Department should continue to express its concern over the destruction of cemeteries, urging that officials maintain them in a suitably respectful manner, unquote. In other words, officials would not allow an investigation of any alleged burial sites as it would desecrate the sacred ground. Now, in conjunction with this, there was a detailed forensic examination of the site of wartime Treblinka, and they used a sophisticated electronic ground radar. They found no evidence of mass graves there. For 6 days in October 1999, an Australian team, of course it's not covered under the jurisdiction of the commission here in this country, headed by Richard Kriege, K-R-E-G-E, a qualified electronics engineer, carried out an examination of the soil at the site of the former Treblinka II camp in Poland, where Holocaust historians say more than 500,000 Jews were put to death in gas chambers and then buried in mass graves. According to the Encyclopedia of the Holocaust, which was published in 1997, for example, a total of 870,000 people were killed and buried at Treblinka between July 1942 and April 1943. Then, between April and July 1943, the hundreds of thousands of corpses were allegedly dug up and burned in batches of 2,000 to 2,500 on large grids made of railway ties. Krigi's team used an $80,000 ground penetration radar, a GPR device, which sends out vertical radar signals that are visible on a computer monitor. GPR detects any large-scale disturbances in the soil, in the soil structure to a normal effective depth of 4 or 5 meters, and sometimes up to 10 meters. GPR devices are routinely used around the world by geologists, archaeologists, and police. In its Treblinka investigation, Krigi's team also carried out visual soil inspections and used an auger to take numerous soil core samples. The team carefully examined the entire Treblinka II site, especially the alleged mass graves portion, and carried out control examinations of the surrounding area. They found no soil disturbance consistent with the burial of hundreds of thousands of bodies, or even evidence that the ground had ever been disturbed. In addition, Krigi and his team found no evidence of individual graves, bone remains, human ashes, or wood ashes. And of course, this should have been detectable even after 60 years. Okay, now back to the National Museum. To fund this National Museum, the Commission recommended a public-private partnership to include, and I quote, large individual contributions, foundations, associations, institutions, corporations, civic organizations, churches, and synagogues, unquote. Because of the size of the project, while it is largely non-governmental, the funding must involve, they say, a national effort. And I quote, the Commission deems federal participation crucial to the mobilization and channeling of public concern, unquote. Therefore, the Commission wanted a land grant and governmental status to symbolize federal commitment. Further, the Commission stated, and I quote, the dialectic of a government-private partnership, a national center with grassroots programming, and an academic endeavor with ethical exploration would in itself be an extraordinary cultural and political model, unquote. The commission consisted of, and I want you to keep these names in mind, very interesting. It seems like a lengthy list of names, and you think, oh gosh, why bother with telling who the people are? But it's very important to do this. The commission consisted of James J. Blanchard, Judith Flaschner, Frank R. Lautenberg, William Lehman, Arthur J. Goldberg, Hyman Bookbinder, Rudy Boschkowitz, Alfred Gottschalk, Claiborne Pell, Arnold M. Picker, S. William Green, Robert McAfee Brown, Gerson D. Cohen, Theodore Hesburgh, Bernard S. Raskus, Lucy S. Davidovitz, John C. Danforth, Raul Hilberg, Hadasha Rosensaft, Kitty Dukakis, Henry M. Jackson, Bayard Rustin, Benjamin R. Epstein, Norman Lamb, Marilyn Shubin, Isaac B. Singer, Stephen J. Solars, Richard B. Stone, Sigmund Strolchiltz, Mark Talisman, Telford Taylor, Glenn E. Watts, and Sidney R. Yates. Telford Taylor was the chief U.S. prosecutor at Nuremberg. He helped establish the guidelines for trying war criminals after World War II, which became a model in future years for similar tribunals around the globe. Do we see any vested interest or collusion here? Bookbinder said that he hoped that its recommendations, the recommendations of the commission would contribute to sustaining and increasing an American consciousness and conscience, which is essential to maintaining our commitment to Israel. And that is a quote. The advisory board of the President's Commission on the Holocaust. Not only do we have a commission, but we also have a bunch of people who are going to advise the commission. And this advisory board was composed of Sylvia Becker, Michael Barenbaum, who is one of the editors of some of these many books that of these 66 books that the Holocaust Museum has put out, Irving Bernstein, Thomas Bergenthal, Yaffa Eliak, Max C. Gettinger, Helen Joy Ginsberg, Aaron Goldman, Isaac Goodfriend, Grace C. Grossman, Marvin Heyer, Richard Krieger, Miles Lerman, Paul Lewis, Franklin Littell, Frank Logue, Stephen A. Ludson, Benjamin Mead, J. M. Schechter, Richard Schifter, Nathan Chappelle, Wilton S. Sog, Abraham Spiegel, Mark H. Tannenbaum, Siggy B. Wilzig, Erwin R. Ziff, and Solomon Zinstein. On September 27, 1979, the commission recommended the creation of a National Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., with three components: a national memorial, an educational organization, and a committee on conscience. The commission recommended the appointment of a committee on conscience composed of distinguished moral leaders in America. This committee would receive, and of course the Jews know exactly who they want to choose as the moral leaders in America. This committee would receive reports of genocide, actual or potential, anywhere in the world. In the event of any outbreak, it would have immediate access to the president, the Congress, and the public in order to alert the national conscience, influence policymakers, and stimulate worldwide action to bring such acts to a halt. And that was a quote. It would then advocate, and I quote, strong action on the part of the United States, other countries, or the United Nations, unquote. Obviously, this committee is very subjective, as it would not even consider the Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. In 1980, the United States Congress voted unanimously to establish the museum. Congress allotted 1.9 acres of prime publicly owned land adjacent the Washington Monument for construction. The commission concluded that the memorial should be in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the seat of government. They want the museum materials to affect all Americans and raise national consensus that, yes, there was a Holocaust. And can't you see that there was? Because look at this great big huge museum. Obviously there was a Holocaust. The museum recognized America for its need, and I quote, to confront and remember the Holocaust, unquote. And the part that Herbert Pell, the U.S. representative to the War Crimes Commission, played in charging Germans of war crimes against humanity. The Nuremberg Military Tribunal established, and I quote, a new international moral standard, for they reflect the conviction that every individual is responsible for his actions, even in times of war, unquote. This is the same Herbert Pell who collaborated with the State Department to manufacture a war crimes policy. This was only applicable to the nations that lost the war. The tribunal did not hold the winners responsible for the horrendous war crimes that they committed, including all of those war crimes in Germany. According to the commission, and I quote, General Dwight D. Eisenhower insisted that the concentration camps be fully documented and photographed, unquote. The commission commended the American soldiers who operated the displaced persons camps. The commission also recommended a cooperative alliance with the Smithsonian Institution. Effective January 1st, 2006, Showtime got an exclusive contract with the Smithsonian. Taxpayers fund the Smithsonian Institution with about $800 million a year. Prior to this contract in 2006, all filmmakers used the vast holdings of the archives to produce accurate historical pieces. Now, access is restricted to Showtime, who interprets history for millions of viewers, including the history of the alleged Holocaust. Showtime has full, exclusive access to millions of historical documents, film, photographs, and thousands of hours of recordings unavailable anywhere else in the world. Other legitimate interested parties must seek permission from Showtime, the Smithsonian's new collaborator, to access those resources. CBS owns Showtime, and Sumner Redstone, born Rothstein, owns 70% of its voting stock. So it doesn't matter that the taxpayers spend $800 million to fund the Smithsonian. Only the Jews have access to all of its resources. They use those resources to create our perceptions of history, what they want us to believe. The first director of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, Jesha Adjahu Weinberg, a founding director of the Tel Aviv Museum, and chairman Miles Learman, raised almost $190 million from private sources. They used this for the architectural design, artifact acquisition, and to create the exhibition. Groundbreaking ceremonies occurred on October 16, 1985. In October 1988, President Ronald Reagan spoke when they laid the cornerstone of the building, designed by James Ingo Fried, a Jew born in Germany in 1930. Although he immigrated to the United States in 1939, people still consider him and everyone else who happened to leave Germany a Holocaust survivor. Construction on the building began in July 1989. In 1988, to commemorate Holocaust Memorial Day, the Jews initiated an international educational program called the March of the Living, in which Jewish high school students from throughout the world participate by marching silently from Auschwitz to Birkenau, designed to contrast the so-called death marches, which occurred towards the end of World War II, supposedly. Last year, 10,000 students marched from April 15th to the 20th. Just before the march, on March 6, 2000, the Polish Daily News of New York City asked, and I quote, "Can you appreciate Israel if you haven't seen Auschwitz?" unquote. After thousands of Jewish youth commemorate Yom HaShoah in Poland, they travel to Israel, where they celebrate Independence Day. During the march, chaperones inculcate the young Jews with the Zionist message. One year at Auschwitz, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin told them, and I quote, "The world is divided into two parts, those who actively participated with the Nazis and those who passively collaborated with them," unquote. To convince the youth that they might be in impending danger in Poland, armed Israeli security guards accompany the tour. According to author Peter Novick, and I quote, "Israel and the Holocaust are the twin pillars of American Jewish civil religion, the symbols that bind together Jews in the United States, whether they are believers or non-believers, on the political right, left, or center," unquote. Holocaustianity, a new religion, could now become even stronger in America. Officials dedicated the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum on April 22, 1993, with special speeches by President Bill Clinton, Israeli President Chaim Herzog, Chairman Harvey Meyerhoff, and Elie Wiesel. Distinguished leaders of nations from around the world attended. The museum opened on April 26th with Weinberg as the director, and he was the director from 1993 until 1999. On June 6, 1994, officials dedicated the Eisenhower Plaza in honor of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces in Europe. He is the guy that supervised the 200 death enclosures, and they were enclosed by barbed wire, in post-war Germany, where over 1 million Germans starved to death. We can't call them camps because they didn't have any facilities. No food, no water, no hospitals, no barracks, no infirmary, no post office, none of the amenities that the Germans provided in their camps. In 1999, the United States Holocaust Memorial Council, the museum's governing body, elected Sarah J. Bloomfield as the museum's second director. Joshua B. Bolton, former director of Office of Management and Budget, and Bush's former chief of staff, is the vice chairman of the council. He recruited Henry Paulson, Goldman Sachs CEO, as the Treasury Secretary based on his former employment at that firm. He was the co-chair of the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund, which raised $36 million, which they turned around and used to build hotels and everything in plush hotels in Haiti. The victims of the Haiti earthquake are still waiting around, but they've got those great hotels. In 2002, George W. Bush appointed Tom A. Bernstein, one of the principal owners of the Texas Rangers and a CFR member, to the Museum Council. Bernstein, co-founder and chairman of the International Freedom Center, is the museum chairman. Sarah Bloomfield, who I mentioned before, established the National Institute for Holocaust Education, a center for advanced Holocaust studies, and the Academy for Genocide Prevention. She has made the museum a global institution that raises Holocaust awareness worldwide and confronts Holocaust denial. The museum has an operating annual budget of almost $80 million, of which the government, meaning the taxpayers, supply $47.3 million, while private donations provide the rest. By 2008, the museum had about 400 employees, 125 contractors, 650 volunteers, 91 Holocaust survivors, and 175,000 members. There are branch museums in New York, Boston, Boca Raton, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Dallas. In addition to the official U.S. museums, there are others numbering at least 33 just in America. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has over 12,750 artifacts, 49 million pages of archival documents, 80,000 historical photographs, 200,000 registered survivors, 1,000 hours of archival footage, 84,000 library items, and 9,000 oral history testimonies. It has teacher associates in every state and almost 400 university fellows from 26 countries have visited the museum since 1994. Does all of this confer credibility on an event in which no one has provided a shred of scientific evidence proving that something akin to a Holocaust occurred? All this money, all of these artifacts, all of these people, but not a shred of scientific evidence. The only verifiable Holocaust that occurred in Germany was the genocidal fiery whirlwind of the Allied bombing. Another notable deliberate mass genocide was Stalin's starvation of at least 6 and perhaps as many as 7 million in the Ukraine in 1932 and 33. Where are their museums? But then, Goyim are, after all, mere cattle. Why would we merit a museum? Michael Barenboim, who I mentioned before, a professor, rabbi, writer, and filmmaker, specializes in the study of the memorialization of the Holocaust. He is the deputy director of the President's Commission on the Holocaust. He was the deputy director of the President's Commission on the Holocaust from 1979 through 1980. He was the project director of the museum from 1988 to 1993. He was the director of the Holocaust Research Institute from 1993 to 1997. He played a major role in the creation of the government agency and the content of its permanent exhibition. He claims that Germany was, and I quote, a genocidal state, unquote. I wonder what he considers the U.S., which has participated in every overt and many covert wars, bombed numerous cities in Japan after that country offered to surrender, bombed Germany back to the Stone Age, and since 1973 has sanctioned the killing of 55 million innocent children under the pretense of freedom of choice. Gloria Steinem, a Jew, Betty Friedan, a Jew, Bella Abzug, a Jew, and Shirley Chisholm co-founded the National Women's Political Caucus in July 1971, a group that spearheaded the Supreme Court's abortion decision. Given the composition of the current court, and now with the implementation of Obamacare, expect more of the same. Predictably, the addition of the elderly as targets of death. Regarding the three-pronged focus of the museum, number one, the mausoleum-style museum, number two, the educational organization, and number three, the Committee on Conscience, the educational apparatus is the most troublesome. In addition to an online workshop, the museum offers workshops and conferences on-site at the museum and in your state. On December 7th through the 9th, 2012, the taxpayer-funded museum held an international conference where scholars presented papers on World War II, Nazi crimes, and the Holocaust, and they had this conference in the USSR. In Russia. They held it at the National Research University Higher School of Economics in Moscow. This conference was just one of many such museum-sponsored gatherings. And coincidentally, on March 26th, just a year, well, not quite a year, from December, okay, a few months, 4 months, on March 26th, 2013, Russia Today published an article entitled, Russia Moves to Criminalize Holocaust Denial. The article states, and I quote, the Russian lower house has received a new bill suggesting up to 5 years in prison for publicly denying the Holocaust or portraying Nazis as heroes, unquote. So within just 4 months, this country has now all of a sudden decided that they're going to criminalize Holocaust questioning or denial. Senator Boris Spiegel, a pharmaceutical tycoon, an ardent Jew, sponsored that bill in Russia. On June 22, 2010, he founded and is the chairman of World Without Nazism. Upon its founding, he received a letter of support from Hillary Clinton. He is also the chairman of World Congress of Russian Jewry, the WCRJ. He said, as a historic victim of genocide, he called for the establishment of a tribunal that would investigate Georgia's war crimes in 2008 during that war. While Benjamin Netanyahu initially proposed the idea, it was Spiegel, who was the force behind the monument dedicated to the memory of the Soviet Red Army soldiers that they recently erected in the Israeli city of Netanya. They unveiled the monument on June 25, 2012, and Putin attended the ceremony. Now, this is very interesting, given that the Red Army raped between about 2 million women, females, between the ages of 8 and 80 during their invasion, or what they called their liberation of Germany. And yet they get this monument. And it was a Jew from Russia collaborating with the Israeli state that made this happen. Now, back to that special commission. I have taken the following directly from the President's Commission on the Holocaust in 1979, which elucidates the Commission's national objectives, many of which it has fulfilled. And I quote, "The Commission recommends that there be included as part of the Holocaust Memorial an educational foundation dedicated to the pursuit of educational work through grants, extension services, joint projects, research and exploration of issues raised by the Holocaust for all areas of human knowledge and public policy," unquote. And another quote, "The foundation should stimulate and support such work in all sections of the country within existing programs, both academic and educational, as well as within the network of institutions that deal with the Holocaust. The Educational Foundation should also assist with the development of appropriate curricula and resource material while working cooperatively with those school systems which wish to implement the study of the Holocaust. The Washington Center would function as a clearinghouse for the exchange of information. To implement the conviction of the Commission that the study of the Holocaust become part of the curriculum in every school system in the country, the foundation should include various support systems, financial aid, evaluation of Holocaust courses presently offered in public and private schools, consortia, conferences, teacher training workshops, and summer institutes for educators and scholars," unquote. And here's another quote. "In the area of higher education, the foundation should make available to scholars and graduate students fellowships for research and travel, as well as matching grants for institutions or faculty who work with students. Other activities to be coordinated by the Educational Foundation would involve project funding, translations into English of important works in many languages, and a visiting faculty program. The Commission recommends that a publishing program be part of the Educational Foundation, with priority given to out-of-print classics, new works of special merit, survivors' accounts, and documentary or photographic publication. Emphasis should also be placed on scholarly studies, which are essential to an understanding of the Holocaust, but which are not commercially viable," unquote. Okay, basically what they're talking about is propaganda and programming. Reiteration of the so-called, of the official version. As I mentioned before, the taxpayer-funded United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has sponsored and published 66 books about the Holocaust. That is just what they have published. That does not include the hundreds of thousands of other books relating to the Holocaust, promoting it as a historical fact that one must not even question. Finally, and this is another quote, "Finally, in recognition of the powerful educational role of the media, the foundation should offer development grants and prizes for work in the arts, literature, and the media. Because of the Commission's conviction that the teaching of the Holocaust is a critical dimension of the living memorial, the Educational Foundation is proposed to complement the museum by helping and encouraging the introduction of the study of the Holocaust in junior and senior high schools and universities, as well as by stimulating the development of resources for such teaching and study. Further, the Educational Foundation would encourage research on the Holocaust and promote the interaction of scholars and educators," unquote. Another quote, Teacher training is another major area for the Educational Foundation, a need intensified by the growth in the number of colleges and secondary schools teaching the Holocaust. By 1985, over 1,000 school systems would offer specific courses. Students in grades 6 and above demonstrate the ability to empathize with individual eyewitness accounts and to attempt to understand the complexities of this history, including the scope and scale of events. While elementary schools are able to empathize with individual accounts, they often have difficulty placing them in a larger historical context. Elementary school can be an ideal location to just begin discussion of the value of diversity and the danger of bias and prejudice. These critical themes can be addressed through local and national historical events. This will be reinforced during later study of the Holocaust. Please note that the Commission bases its projected school curriculum on eyewitness accounts rather than on actual science and history. I feel like banging my desk here. The foundation could also sponsor or co-sponsor social science research on the effects of trauma on survivors and their children, unquote. Predictably, a new Israeli study finds signs of trauma in grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. The study detects unprocessed, indirect signs of post-trauma or problems in communication and interaction system. Haaretz News recently reported, and I quote, "One of the most controversial subjects in academic research on the Holocaust is the trauma's impact on future generations. A new study carried out by Haifa University argues that Holocaust trauma signs can be identified among third-generation grandchildren," unquote. The American Civil Liberties Union ought to defy all institutions preaching the Holocaust in any public place and forbid all public funds from supporting this religion of the New World Order. The First Amendment, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, repudiates the teaching of any religion in state institutions. Almost 30 million people have paid sacred homage at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. 2 million people visit annually. Dr. Robert Brock, the publisher of The Holocaust Dogma of Judaism, Keystone of the New World Order, in his foreword of that book argues that the taxpayer-funded Holocaust museums constructed in America violate the Constitution as they give preferential treatment and promote one religion above others. They also insinuate that the alleged suffering of one religious and or ethnic group excels and is more historically significant than other groups, such as the millions of black slaves seized in Africa and brought to America by Jewish slave trade promoters before the Civil War. Public, government-paid teachers in America teach the Holocaust, again, accorded a special status by the government, as historical fact, and no student dare question or dispute its history, despite the lack of scientific evidence. The dogma makes all willing believers participants in Holocaustianity or Holocaustians. Ancient prophecies, Ancient prophecies require that 6 million Jews must vanish before the Jews can create the State of Israel. They can return minus 6 million. Tom Segev, an Israeli historian, declared that the 6 million is an effort to convert the Holocaust story into a state religion. According to the Talmud, 6 million had to disappear in burning ovens. Robert B. Goldman writes, and I quote, "Without the Holocaust, there would be no Jewish state," unquote. A simple consequence, given 6 million Jews gassed Auschwitz, who ended up in the burning ovens, the Greek word Holocaust means burned offerings. Therefore, the prophecies have now been fulfilled, and Israel can become a legitimate state. The First Amendment prohibits the federal and state governments from establishing an official religion or from favoring or disfavoring one view of religion over another. Yet, little by little, that is what they did. If one ran the numbers, there are probably more Holocaustians in this country than any other denomination. The Holocaust dogma of Judaism, keystone of the New World Order, explains why the number of Jews missing when they founded the State of Israel had to be 6 million, a magic, symbolical figure, in order to fulfill prophecy. The Holocaust doctrine is a Jewish religious belief. Therefore, number one, public institutions may not legally teach it according to the current Supreme Court interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. Number two, the museums documenting the religious belief of the Holocaust and holding liturgies and candlelight ceremonies are in reality synagogues, temples, or places of Jewish worship. Therefore, cannot be erected on public property or financed by Congress, no matter how subservient the Congress may be to Zionist pressure. Congress has already institutionalized Holocaustianity with your money and granting public land to that museum, to that huge synagogue they're sitting next to the Washington Memorial. The United States Holocaust Memorial Council's recent legislation mandates Holocaust educational program throughout the country in both religious and secular contexts. Because the religious community has a special interest in the Holocaust, the Council established the Committee on Church Relations and the Holocaust to engage the various Christian organizations in the United States to fulfill that mandate. Since 1970, government schools promote the celebration of Earth Day on April 22nd. In 1990, Dennis Hayes, the original national coordinator, launched an international Earth Day and organized events in 141 nations. People in 175 countries now celebrate Earth Day every year. In 2009, the UN, the entity for world governance, designated April 22nd, which is coming up here later this month, as International Mother Earth Day. Earth Day converts the worship of the Creator to the worship of the creation. Additionally, April 22nd is Vladimir Lenin's birthday. I wonder if there is some connection. We no longer hear the term Easter. It is now spring break. Merry Christmas has become Happy Holidays. Manger scenes are no longer politically correct. We now have the celebratory lighting of the national menorah at the White House and a kosher White House kitchen. Jews have always functioned as their own God. They do not need the crucified and resurrected Christ, inasmuch as they can compel an entire nation to worship in a shrine honoring 6 million allegedly dead Jews. Millions of pages of convoluted Talmudic-like laws impose restrictions on every aspect of our lives, including the composition of children's sack lunches. The United States Holocaust Memorial Council's legislation mandates Holocaust educational program throughout the country in both religious and secular entities. Because the religious community has a special interest in the Holocaust, I already said that. Okay, so we're basically, we are a Talmudic country. We are a nation of Holocaustians, and yet there's not a shred of scientific evidence. Anyway, tomorrow is the day that that many will be celebrating. I certainly won't be celebrating, but many will be celebrating Remembrance Day. I hope you do something that you feel is is complimentary to the day. Alrighty, thanks for listening today. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.